Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And tonight, another very interesting show dealing with esoteric realities, yes, otherwise known as metaphysics and spirituality, science, certainly some science, interesting science tonight, and physics and metaphysics and, well, just anything else. But tonight's show is called Esoteric Reality, God's Window Through the Soul. Just the title itself is kind of esoteric. What is that? You know? So it should be an interesting show, because one of the things I'm going to talk about tonight may be, or I think it was likely to be, somewhat of a revelation for a number of people, because most people have, will say, a misconception about, as far as I'm concerned, about God, and that is that God as a being already knows everything, already is all-powerful, already is all-everything. And this is only true in a macro scale, but it kind of inverts itself at our level of reality. So we would call it a super micro scale at our reality. But at any rate, it is a kind of strange thing, because on the macro level, God is everything. But on the micro level, in general, throughout the universe, except by our own perception, it is something other than that. And as a matter of fact, if we look at quantum physics, we know from quantum physics, as best as physics can explain something, that as you become into the super, super nano type, smaller micro world, there is only probabilities, and even those have no definiteness to themselves. And if God is everything, then that part of our universe, where God exists, obviously, then it would be a God that doesn't choose to know everything. As a matter of fact, is what we would maybe somewhat sacrilegiously in some religions say, that it is a being who is unknowable to some extent, but unknowable to itself as well, because it has what we would claim, based upon our understandings, again, which could be obviously faulty, that it doesn't have a certainty to itself at that level. Yeah, quantum physics says there is no such thing as certainty within the super small world that exists around us in this particular dimension, in the most uncertain of ways. So this is a very interesting factor, and there's a kind of strange corollary to this, and that is getting into the more metaphysical aspects of quantum physics. As one moves into the higher dimensions of time and space, God has an even greater duality from the two aspects that I'm talking about. In other words, the quantum constant that we consider to be the uncertainty principle about, we'll call it matter and things, it grows enormously. It's very small here, but it grows enormously. And that means that the mind of God takes precedence, and there's a reason for this now, so I'm going to explain that the mind of God, which is spirit, grows very quickly in proportion to what we call the activity of God, or the chosen and non-chosen actions of God. And that means that the thought dominates much more the universe. And God's thought, being spirit, has a dominating factor over what we call matter greater level. And so uncertainty becomes more certain because it's being controlled by thought much greater than at the levels where we are, where thought has very little effect on, even God's thought, has very little effect on activity or material things, things that we call matter. And therefore, because of that, we can look at this process as God expressing itself in each dimension that is lower from the highest dimension in the universe, in a way which is much more uncertain, even within its own knowingness. Now you might say, "Whoa!" So you're saying God doesn't know everything that's going to happen, and it doesn't want to apparently know everything that's going to happen, particularly as the dimensions become more uncertain and more affected by the shrinking of the quantum constant, and therefore matter has a kind of a mind of its own. We call it gravity, but kind of a mind of its own. And so this is very important because it changes the nature of God, souls, and us, people. It gives us something to really take pause with, and it means that the God that exists in our universe, and I came to this conclusion dating myself now, a long time ago, almost 50 years ago, I came to this conclusion about God based upon my studies in physics at the time, and also my experiences in isolation tanks where I had some out-of-body experiences, and I realized through those out-of-body experiences, the most important thing I realized was that the quantum constant had changed. And as soon as I came to that conclusion that the quantum constant had changed, it took me a number of visits before I could even get my bearings straight enough to do some pretty, we'll call it, by today's standards, myself, lame experiments, but they were good enough to discover that the quantum constant had effectively changed and grown. And then I started putting two and two together, and I started to realize that the God that was the God I was perceiving, and at the time I didn't believe in God in the beginning of it, but then as I began to believe in it, I saw a God very different than what I supposed God to be. That God was a God of growth, a God of change, a God of creation, but not creation and then just sort of sitting around. A God of creation that part of its experience it wanted to be, at least in part of the universe, that particularly the part where humans live in, to experience the excitement, I guess you would call it, but also the interest and the tremendous amount of meaning that comes from things being uncertain and only making them more certain through the process of becoming more spiritual versus less spiritual. And so this is a whole fascinating change in, we'll call it, world view. And my worldview changed from this, more from the perspective of a scientist kind of person. You could get the same change in worldview through all kinds of different life experiences. It could be through beauty and art. It could be through maybe a business person working as an entrepreneur and a creator in certain ways. There's so many different perspectives that one could achieve the same kind of conclusion from. But nonetheless, it is a big one. And it runs counter to most religions. Now, you might say, well, if the religions have it wrong, isn't that part of God, too? Now, they didn't have it wrong in the beginning in most cases. Religions were changed from being open-ended, creative, we'll call it a God that doesn't exist in some absolute definitive space and time, and self, is determined by God. That God, which is an absolute deterministic God, is a God chosen by humans to interpret God through a specific religion that oftentimes didn't start that way. Now, why would human beings want to take a open-ended religion that says that God is a free-forming God, that there is no deterministic elements to, and want to make it deterministic? Well, because a deterministic God can be then used to make absolute statements and control over others if you're the boss of God, meaning the head of the church or heads of the church. And that's the reason. Humans have a desire for power and control due to their personalities and other factors. Some of them are playing down out evil. And the process, not all, and the process then is to try to control others, particularly other people, by convincing them that God is deterministic and therefore you must follow the thought of God as in an edict stated by those who claim to be or are, in effect, in power and control through religion. So this is how it gets circuitously changed into the God that isn't real. It's the unreal God, the non-esoteric reality, but the definite, unfortunate, mundane reality of most religious standards. So, that being the case, we are here to experience a reality that even God doesn't have fully understood. That's very important, because it means that there is no deterministic model. In theory, if God was all-knowing in the sense of everything that exists now and into the future, then we would have a major problem, because we would again not have the freedom that God seeks for us in life, because there would be an absolute deterministic, quote-unquote, truth of all things that would eventually stymie and hamper us from being creative and free. And so this model has to be this way. Now, I didn't come to that conclusion until considerably later in my, we'll say, thinkings about the whole process and experiences as well. And so consequently, God is watching through the window of our soul, and I'll explain that next, that gives it a collective through all of us in umpteen uncountable worlds, a view of the reality of this specific dimension and the next two. Because those three dimensions, at least the lower mental, and then the full dimension of the astral and the physical, eventually the physical, we are only still learning about the etheric or electromagnetic parts of the physical. But still, we've got a pretty good grasp on it. And God is understanding the nature of this as we creatively change it to some extent and also understand it, both. And God sees this through our soul, because the soul can't be here to experience it, because if it did, it could not determine esoteric reality. It can only then experience what we experience, which is mostly illusion. So, and you've heard me say this before if you've listened, as a means of protection and not going through the illusions as much as humans do anyway, the soul creates us, human being, a part of itself, to take on senses, and it's the senses that become illusions, not the spirit that things first. And those senses cause us to then maybe turn away from some of the spiritual ideas of God. But still, the soul remains, we'll call it, somewhat separated and pure from the events of the reality we are in presently, And it gains the experiences through those parts of us that work out the illusions and come to the esoteric reality. Only when we experience reality, the real from the unreal, does the soul gain. And then does God gain through the collection of all souls. So this is how it works. And so the God's window through the soul is a kind of a porthole into its ability to enjoy and get meaning from the experiences of humans as they pass through the different stages of illusion and come to the reality of things. Now, what happens to all the illusions? Well, the illusions is the chaos in some respects. It's the part of the uncertainty that doesn't follow the big picture of God. And this is the most fascinating, I think, of the whole subject to it. And that is that God allows us freedom for this absolute uncertainty to actually go into the completely wrong direction, I call it wrong, of falling into illusion, away from esoteric reality or hidden reality, and to become non-spiritual, and we call it evil, away from God. And this is an acceptable part of the process so that we can have freedom. Otherwise, if God said, well, you can't do that, then ultimately that would lead to us being somewhat on the string and the puppeteer is doing the work. So we're given this freedom, and it needs to be there. It confounds the process. It slows up the process and destroys some of what God's major creation is, which is us, life. And it destroys some of that life, but in the process, it allows that life to eventually create so much more that it's compensated for by the need and the reality of creation itself, and we need to be creators, eventually co-creators with God, and only by allowing us to choose not to do that, and to even to do the opposite, can it ultimately be achieved. So it's a fascinating way of looking at something that is more probably misunderstood than understood in today's world. I'm going to bring it into a lot of contexts in our present world, but for right now, we're just talking about the big picture concept. And so God is seeking a means, a way to experience both our errors, but not in a way in which the errors become an intrusion to God's existence, only an intrusion to God's love. Existence is something different. So it affects in some ways what we call consciousness of God, but which is part of its spirit. But it doesn't affect its existence. And the same is true of the soul. The soul and God are in the same part of the bleachers on that part, in that situation. And we're in another section entirely, where, of course, we pay dearly moving down a path of darkness. But the payment is only caused by our own actions and not by, we'll call it not by simply being part of the system. And a lot of people think otherwise. Now, this is where it gets complicated. A lot of people think that, oh, well, I'm a victim because I'm here or there, and others are victimizing me. But that's not exactly true, and if you look at it from a karmic side, you wouldn't be where you are if there wasn't a reason related to something some actions on your part, either now or possibly sometime before now, which could be a prior life. Most of the time, if you're over about 49 years old, you could figure almost all of your karma is coming from the present life. But there's no absolute guarantee of that, by the way. And that's mostly true. And that's, of course, what they call the first third life. The first third of a person's life is guided more by karma from prior lives. Now, this isn't true of all people. It's true of the average folk. And in the second third, now that's 49 more years, and most people are dead by then, I realize, but in a perfect world, that's not necessarily the way it has to be. But that is guided by the immediacy of the karma that you create during that specific part of your life only. Okay, so from 49 to 98, you could claim that your life is being guided from moment to moment by what you choose and don't choose at those moments. And then from the remainder of your reality, you're freed. If you live past 98, in theory, you're freed from the karma of your past life, and you should have enough wisdom developed in the second part so that you cease to create new karma issues in the immediate sense. And then the future, the next 49 years, which leads up to age 147, and most of us aren't going to make it that far, your karma then becomes what you choose to take on from others by the amount that you can imbibe in them and help them to discover wisdom for themselves with love wisdom. And it comes from you giving it and them using it more. So that's supposedly the way it's supposed to work. Of course, very few people experience the reality I just said. But if we look at it from that perspective, we could say that from our point of view, most people in their later adult years are really not experiencing the karma of a prior life. And they are further, if they are spiritual, not experiencing much problems from their present situation. But there are people, now I said this is the average folk, there are people who take on tremendous karma on a national, world scale. They do so because they're spiritually serving in such ways, and that's a whole different thing. They have a completely different set of, we'll say, criteria for how they function. And in either case, however you want to put it all together, God is seeking, through the window of the soul, to experience the realities of our world. And it isn't taking on the experience of the human on the negative side of things. Only the positive. And the same would be said of the soul as well. When I say soul, that applies to both the human soul and it's called the alter ego, the angelic being that is connected to it, sometimes known as the soul or angel. But regardless of how you want to call it, the soul does not, in angel's wisdom particularly, take on the negative aspects of the human's life. It barely knows in a direct way of negative things, which we tend to do on a very selfish level, moment to moment throughout our days. It knows and experiences the truth of existence and the virtuous things we do. And that goes right through to God. So God sees esoteric reality through the soul, but not illusion. And therefore, this gets into a whole other can of worms, you might say, that the God that I'm speaking of seeks to not have a full a complete understanding of what we'll call evil, the dark side, etc. And you might say, well, why not? Why would God, which wants to create life, not know its enemy, so to speak, that is a part of the human kingdom, which we call evil. Yes, evil only exists in its native form within the human kingdom. So now we can imbue it onto animals and other things, but basically it's a human condition. And there's a fascinating idea about this, at least as far as, this goes back again in time in my own thinking about this many, many years ago, 40 or more years ago, I was thinking about this particular element of God. And it seems that, to me, that from the perspective of God, it is not going to be the one who fights evil. It's not going to be the one who destroys evil. And I will get to the exceptions to what I'm saying in a minute, but it is the one who seeks instead to allow evil to have the freedom even of believing, and somewhat in a true way, that God will not directly come after it and do anything to it. And if you listen to evil people speak, that's pretty much what they say. It's fascinating, but sometimes it's not in as literal a fashion as I just said it, but they say things that, with impunity, they challenge the rights and the lives of others without any concern for there being a retribution. And oddly, they sometimes even believe there is a God. Actually, they believe it most of the time, but many times they won't admit to it. Sometimes they fanatically believe there's a God. But in their fanaticism, they don't have any concern for, and they make up rationalizations for, the fact that God will not stop them from doing atrocious things. Think about it. You've heard some of the speeches of Achaemenid. He's the president, presently, of the state of Iran. Now, he's not the head of the state. The mullahs and the other folks that are running things behind the scenes, they're doing all this stuff. But he's the voice. Okay. And what does his voice say? He says, well, we're going to wipe out Israel because, they took all the Arab lands and they were given these lands without justification, they should be there an abomination, they should be destroyed, and we should kill them. And he says he should do this because it's the right thing to do. And just as it's the right thing to torture and kill people who don't believe in his particular version of Islam. And to kill people who are not Muslims in general. And to do a lot of other stuff. Well, okay, why does he have such impunity about that if he truly is, quote-unquote, a religious guy? Well, remember, first of all, religions have taken the God that is free and wants freedom into a God that dictates and says, thou shalt, and they get a lot of bad things going on after the shalt. And so it becomes we'll say, a comfort on his part, and also a way of gaining power and control over others, that his God gives him the right to do these things. Well, we call those things evil, and I think most people would, because they want to kill people. It's usually not a good idea to become a mass murderer. But if you're going to do so, and you're evil, and this is one of the ways to, by the way, see evil, is that it has this characteristic to it. I call it a callous detachment from the outcomes of its outrageous activities. And we see this going all around us. I've recently, today, saw some outcomes from what looks like evil acts on the part of what's going on in our government in the United States. But about what happened in Libya. And it's continuing to be noticed. These things are noticed, but people don't say, well, that's evil, because they don't understand the nature. And the nature is that it just has this amazing, we'll say, a laissez-faire attitude about God. Because, in a way, God contributes to it. Yes, by giving freedom. God says, you're free, and then everybody says, well, if I'm free, then God must like me, and God must think I'm a cool cat, even though I'm going to go kill people. So that's a good God, and that's a God that I like. And so you can see how this really is a strange thing. God does it for a different reason than to encourage mass murderers and evil people. It does it because that's the only way that there can be true growth to itself through the life that encourages the growth, especially human life, which is the closest kind of life to its own creator up to the human kingdom. So we have a very fascinating way of looking at God's window through the soul and see what it's doing and how others are positioning themselves within that particular kind of reality. And most people, again, do not necessarily have this viewpoint. But if they did have this viewpoint, they would be able to see esoteric reality much better and be fooled by their illusions, particularly evil stuff, less often, much less often. So the people who have the viewpoint I'm proposing or something similar to it, now this is, again, my opinion, have a much closer viewpoint to esoteric reality and will be much less likely fooled by illusions and especially by evil. The people who don't will obviously have the opposite. And most people don't. So, on Earth at this time, of course. I'm not saying this is going to be forever, guys. But I am saying that at the present time, if we were to assess the world, this is the world we would see. All right. So, I think we're beginning to gain some, we'll call it, conceptual understanding of this principle. It is not an easy one because it goes up the grain, against the grain of so many people who were taught other things and lived them and still do in their religious viewpoints and maybe in their political viewpoints and somewhat in a lot of other ways. It has a lot to do with whether you believe in a deterministic world. I mean, at the bottom of the process. It's much more than that, but it has a lot to do with that. And it also has to do with how you see, you know, like a political sense, is the world a place where others take care of people and the world is a place where creativity is put in the back seat in comparison to security and people having fuzzy warm feelings. Well, yeah, that's one of the lures of some of the socialistic, communistic models, which are actually, the majority of them, the vast majority, are pretty dark and evil. So if you look at that process and you determine where you will fall into it, you can start maybe unraveling some of these questions by today's show. You can start looking at it from, well, maybe my viewpoint on God is a little bit mixed up. And if I listen to this guy, just assume it, and then try to look at the world through that viewpoint, maybe I will be able to see esoteric reality, hidden reality, instead of being controlled by the illusions. Okay, so let's talk more about the illusions at this junction. And God is mostly unconnected or disconnected, and so is the soul from the illusions of the human being. Human beings are not disconnected, and we pay dearly for our illusions. Okay, how is that fair? How come there is no social justice? And the dark side uses this argument very strongly. I want you to understand this. It's a big deal. Now, I believe in love, strongly believe in love, but not the love of giving people what they want or even what they need. You see, there's an interesting correlation here, and I'll get into it. That that people are made better by being given things they want, and if you get past that illusion, which is not too hard to get past, then give them what they need. But if you give people what they need, they won't become creative, so they find ways of meeting their needs themselves, which develops the most important thing they need, which is more consciousness. So you rob them of their consciousness, but you give them a nice soft pillow, a warm blanket, and maybe an interesting meal. So it is a problem in which you have to look at what the needs are in a more reality, a greater reality than the one that you're facing. Because most people put it in terms of the mundane world. And if you put it in terms of the spiritual world, you can almost say you're giving people what they need if you're talking about it in spiritual terms, as a soul would in his God would, through the window of the soul. And so this is the process. It's facing life, and it goes against the specific construct of social justice. Social justice is that everybody should get certain needs met, regardless of who they are, what station of life they have, what they've done in the past, what they're going to do in the future. There is a problem with that, because if everybody does get that, you have to redistribute wealth to achieve it. And once you redistribute wealth, you take away the incentive for people to gain in consciousness and in creativity, which together makes spirit. You take away the spiritual foundation of the government, the economy, and the way of life of people. And that's a very serious problem. It's not insignificant. It's actually fatal, if protracted. In other words, if you do it for a long time, not a year or two, but if you do it for like 10, 20, 40, 60, in that kind of years, you're going to have a society which becomes intolerantly dark, corrupt, self-destructive, and eventually eats itself from the inside out. Okay, so that's what's going to happen. And everybody becomes a slave. The mass of people become slaves to a very small number of people in power, and eventually those people become slaves to material existence, and their life becomes meaningless. So in all aspects, it's a failure model. But God allows us, and this is part of the system. We're here to find this out. Now, we're not here to find it out in some prescribed way, because that would be deterministic. We're here to go bumping along from here to there and everything else, because there's so much uncertainty, we really don't know what the future is going to bring. And it's for us to handle it as it comes up. With that thought in mind, we're going to come back in about 2.5 minutes and talk about some of the more practical issues. I just kind of leading us into that with this last statement I made. And we shall then pursue this subject even further. So I'll be back in 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning, This one book contains more answers, including the wise, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, we're talking about esoteric reality, God's window through the soul. And if you've already heard the first section of the soul, of the show, I should say, you have a pretty good understanding, I think, of what this subject is about. It may not be fully understood, because, let's face it, this is, again, esoteric. Anything that's hidden from people is the part of life that they don't understand. And if they did, they wouldn't probably be necessarily listening to the show other than to maybe get a little review or something. And that's the way, unfortunately, most people are in illusion, and so this is the way it is. God's window through the soul means that God basically lives its existence here through the soul's perception, souls being souls of humans for the most part, but also there could be group souls in a very minor way. Tonight we're talking about the human side of things. Now, to be perfectly frank about this subject, these are my perspectives. 40 to 50 years ago, I started to garner them together and became, we'll say, 40 or less years ago, somewhat better in understanding them and beginning to actually experience challenges to the whole system through out-of-body experiences and scientific experiments of sorts. Now, it is, without question, a difficult subject also from the perspective that almost all the listeners will have probably a different belief structure than what I'm proposing tonight. And that's because, again, religion has changed the esoteric reality into the needs of power and structure and control from its own, we'll say, viewpoint. And this has made it most, we'll say, most seriously compromising its benefits. It doesn't mean that religions don't have great benefits. They still do, but a lot of the benefits that could come out of a religious viewpoint are stymied by an illusion about God itself. And that illusion then proposed and propounded in various rules, we'll say, ways of supposedly living in a specific religion. religions go way overboard and ask us to do things that are contrary to what my understanding is of God and many other people. So looking at it from the peculiar viewpoint of the host, I'm going to try to extend this subject into a more practical understanding in the world around us. So how do you apply this viewpoint if you're going to live in a world in which you and a few others follow a different drummer and see and understand a different reality or reality itself? And others may be mostly an illusion if you, again, buy what I'm proposing. And the first is that you need to have humility, because if you're really going to go down the path less traveled, far less traveled, and one that is, for all intents and purposes, not even seen by others, then certainly if there's bumps on that path that you experience, before you make various assumptions about the nature of those bumps and how they do or do not adversely reflect on others, it would be best to assume the others to be right, taking the path well-traveled, until you become very convinced that the path that you're on is still leading in a direction of enlightenment and God. So that's the first thing. Humility is a big, big part of becoming, we'll say, enlightened enough to function some of the time here as a soul in this world and in the next and the lower mental as well. So all of those worlds require a huge amount of humility. And on the opposite side, if you have egotism, and who doesn't, that's what you really have to fight against. How do you fight against your egotism, which leads you, by the way, to becoming a humble person? And you do so by assuming the viewpoints of others and assuming them to be correct. Now, I do this all the time, or a lot of the time, and some people are perplexed by it because they think I'm really agreeing with them or I'm somehow stupid because I permit them to have their egotistical way of thought and sometimes of doing things, fully having more understanding that what they're doing is wrong and not stopping them or literally going down a road that looks like it's going to lead to a disaster, and oftentimes it does. It costs more money, time, energy. But I do this because, first of all, the humility is more important for me than to be right, even if I am right, in the long run, because although it may cost time and money and energy and cause certain unpleasant effects, it's better that I choose the humble approach. Now, sometimes it's just by being silent, and other times it's by just allowing people to go along, going along with and allowing people to do what they think is the better way. And oftentimes people, when they say this way is really right and it'll work, etc., I do ask them why. And that's perfectly correct if you're being humble. And they'll give me a whole bunch of reasons, and I'll say, well, did you check all those reasons out? And if it isn't a very serious issue and a very dangerous one for them or for others, I go along without necessarily double-checking what they've done. They say, well, why not? Don't you usually say that you should check other people's thoughts so you can understand it better yourself? Yeah, but if their explanation is equally as possible as the one that I think is right, I will oftentimes secede to them as a matter of improving my humility at the cost of some failure that may end up being some problem. And it sounds crazy, I know, but believe it or not, the improvement in humility builds my own consciousness and allows me to perceive better the mistakes they're making so that when the thing falls apart or whatever they did is right, I can come in and be of greater service to them at that point than I could in trying to, quote-unquote, discuss it with them before we reach that point. It's just what I say versus what they say. And I realize that this is a strange way of looking at things. Now, again, I don't do this in life and death or where it gets very serious. But I do it a lot in the in-between gray areas, and there's quite a few of those, where it may not make that much difference. It may be somewhat inconvenient and costly, but not hugely so. And so this is an interesting point. It's part of also being a teacher, that which I sometimes refer to myself as. But it's a teacher really has to have this kind of humility, because one of the ways that people learn is through mistakes. And if you constantly try to get them to avoid every mistake they're going to make, you may make you look better, like, oh, I really know it all and everything. But it doesn't necessarily help them improve their consciousness. And it doesn't, the most important thing is it doesn't help them overcome their egotism. And you could say, well, why not? If you force them to do what you say, why does it overcome their egotism? Because they do what you say with hostility and resentment, and they never really admit to, much less understand, the mistakes that they were necessarily making. It's a very strange perspective, and it only works sometimes in certain ways, and others you need to do something different in. But nonetheless, humility is a big part of the process. Overcoming egotism is the stepping stone to that. Now, you could say, well, what about arrogance? Arrogance is even bigger, isn't it? That's where the egotism affects the astral body and become unloving and all that stuff. Yeah, that's true. People who are arrogant are oftentimes well beyond what I just talked about as being helped. And they only are helped when they, through their arrogance, virtually destroy themselves. Then they get help. But if it gets to such an extreme level before they change, there isn't much you can do as in a teaching way to help somebody. And there isn't much you can do in your own humility to help people who are arrogant. They may use the fact that you're being humble to further attack and destroy you. It's a problem. So what do you do with folks who are arrogant? Well, you sometimes have to use force or power to limit their abilities to be destructive to those you care about and yourselves, with their own needs to be that way in their areas. So this is the principles in Ageless Wisdom that come up. That's when you're getting into you're bridging into the dark area of existence and eventually into evil. Not all arrogant people are evil, but most evil people are arrogant. So that's about the best way to see it. And so it has this nature to itself. Now, is it possible to be evil without arrogance? Rarely, yes. But that's not the common factor. When we try to get to the point where the practical side of today's show makes sense, it is mostly in the realm of the physical and astral. I was just dealing with the mental, of course. But it's in the physical and astral that humans find it practical to face esoteric reality and to overcome their illusions. It's because while we're living in the physical world, when we react emotionally and tie that specifically to reacting in a way that is material, or sometimes called the sensual aspects of existence, we then have a much more, we'll say, impactful outcome in terms of our daily living. Many people live their lives on the basis of how they feel and what they control in a material sense, giving them a false belief or false perspective that that will cause them to live longer and better. Better as far as how they feel. So this is the area where God's window really makes a difference. And where our own illusions about it become almost totally controlling our existence. From my perspective, if people are illusioned about more than half of the time, which, by the way, is a fairly small number compared to where most people's illusion is, they, from that point, they are almost always seriously encumbered by their emotional nature and by their physical one. It is so, we'll say, strong that most people don't realize that their decisions are being made almost entirely by these illusioned perspectives. And let me give you some examples. The majority of people are controlled by their, we'll call it, their vocation or job, what they do to earn a living, as they put it, and by, in an emotional sense, those that they call familiar, are close to them, and or who they have intimate contact with, including sexual. And so it is a, that is what makes up the majority, both of people's lives in the world that we're in right now, and the aspect of your illusions in terms of how they can't be their soul while they're here, and how God cannot gain anything from here, and how they then add to the chaos of the universe, which means that life becomes far less certain. It becomes uncertain, and they feel as though there is a chaotic universe, one in which they may seek things like social justice, socialism, and you name it. They may seek these things because of the fears they have caused by these illusions that I'm talking about. So it's so strange. The personality wants control and security. It develops the illusions about job and profession and making money and having material things mixed with the emotional sensations, or emotional, we'll say, feelings. Sensations are more physical feelings that of those that it is close to in a familiar way, close to it as a close friend, and close to in a sexual way. These are the primary factors that make its existence, and they are all illusion. You might say, well, sex is an illusion. Sex is real, man. You get it on, you buy my thing. Well, sex is illusion because its purpose and its esoteric reality is to exchange energy with another being in a way in which you and that being become one. And you get to feel emotionally how they feel and physically how they feel, and eventually mentally how they think, and vice versa. And so this is the real reason that sex has importance. You could say, whoa, isn't that like that far-out tantric thing, you know? Yeah, tantric sex actually kind of teaches that, but not from this, from the perspective of what really is going on, is that this sexual energy is moving back and forth, that is doing its job in terms of joining the senses of the two people together. And it only works between two people. I know, you could have sex with 20, but or whatever number you want. But it only works between two. That's it. So if you try to get more, you'll get less. Probably get nothing in terms of joining the senses together. All right, so here you go. Now, let's try to put this in perspective. Most people are living, just on a daily basis, the important elements of their lives in ways which are virtually 100% an illusion. And then they come to me sometimes, or they come maybe to you or to anyone, and they say, why is it I don't seem to understand the meaning of life? How come I don't have a grounded sense of reality? How come my life isn't meaningful? Yeah. Well, the answer is, obviously, is you are what you create yourself into. And your creations include the activities that you pursue. And then the senses that you use. And how those senses partake in receiving energy and perceiving the universe around us. Okay, so there's the big bump. We now know why so many people, which I talked about early in the show, are illusions, why they are. Okay, because they're buying into this model, which is what I just suggested. This. And not everybody buys into that model, but the majority of people do, believe me. All right, so what can we do about that? I mean, that's like huge, huge big thing. Well, there are some parts of God that helps out in this situation. First of all, we know that on the big side of God, as you sow, so shall you reap. Okay, so if you're sowing a bunch of non-truthful life experiences that are based upon feeling good and taking from others and having a life in which you try to have more and more things and more money and control over others in terms of power and prestige and position and things like that. All of those things are the anchor of illusion. Right? And if we want a world that's going to improve from that standpoint, God says we've got to allow freedom so that people can destroy themselves and their own lives and interact with others who will do the same to them and for them and with them in return to us. So you've got to allow this. And why is that going to then, or how is that going to then save our world or save any world as screwed up as Earth is? Not all worlds are as screwed up as Earth. And the answer is the following. You need to allow people to go down the wrong path long enough and far enough and hard enough in the path destructive values to the person so that they can no longer tolerate the consequences of their own actions and the actions of those like themselves who are on the pathway. That's kind of the basic foundation of the big picture of God. And it's still on the first part of God's mind side, which is freedom. But you could say, well, it sounds so cruel. What about the social justice? What about taking care of your brother? What about loving everybody? Well, that is love. Love is allowing people to gain the consequences. And now I'm going to tell you something that really is going to probably bother you, if you follow, if you think what I just said is true, not true. And that is that under certain circumstances, you want to accelerate the consequences to a higher level than would take place under normal situations. In other words, it eventually happened, but it may not happen as quickly, but in the process of creation from those who have esoteric reality, they may choose to do things that they know will accelerate the process. In other words, you allow a person to go down the wrong road, and instead of when they get to the fork where they can kind of get out of it, but they're not going to be enough out of it so they're going to really see the reality, you don't help them find the fork, and you let them go right past it and continue down the path that's so destructive. In other words, try and help people a little bit may not be in their best interest. It make you feel better. But I said, well, I tried. And I helped them over this bump or that bump. But they still didn't get better. Well, if you already know they're not going to get better, I mean, you're virtually certain of that, and your consciousness is maybe 10, 100 times higher than theirs, you should not try to defray them from their destructive issues. Just let them continue. Now, you shouldn't push them down or do some kind of nasty trickery so that they're going to get worse and worse. That also would be inappropriate unless they are being so destructive to others that you just need to stop them. And you can use force to stop people in the physical world, it's permitted, but only under certain circumstances. So those circumstances being excluded, we need to, if we're facing esoteric reality, realize that we have to mimic God. God doesn't swoop down and suddenly say, oh, let me show you the right way. Here it is. I'll give you a little breather today. This is, and there's little, angels at the gates. And they open it up for you and say, come in this way. You'll see a nice way to live and it'll be better. No, that doesn't happen. Why doesn't it happen? Because if you already know that it's not going to be successful, it hurts the person. Now, if you think there's a reasonable chance such an activity might help them, sure, go for it. Angels and everything. I don't care what it takes. It's fine. But most cases, the vast number of people just reject it out of hand. They're not going to go with it. Don't do it. I know. Be aware that you're illusion when you do, because it's your own feelings that come into play. Oh, I can't take it. It's so harmful. I can't let them suffer anymore. But the real suffering is deeper. It's about the lack of meaning in your life. And you're not improving it by easing up. It takes great judgment to do this. It takes a person who understands that love is not giving to people. It's love wisdom. It's giving wisely so that they can do the same with others. Not so they just can have some needs met. Or just feel good, which is really an obnoxious part of it. Rewarding someone to feel better only increases their addiction to that feeling. And that does not help the situation. You don't give the drug they need, which is to feel better, every time they demand it or feel like they got to have it or else they're going to have this or that result. That's the worst thing. You are addicting them further to the condition that is causing the problem. I know, this is tough. Tough stuff. Tough love. Some people call it that, don't they? All right, so I just thought, well, maybe at this point we'll take a little bit of a break and allow people to think of and of what we've been talking about. I want to see what I'm going to talk about during this break time. We're going through all the past shows I've been doing. Wow. But I'll talk about David Stacey. He's an eye doctor over in Chandler. And if you haven't had a chance, you should go by and see him, because if you're having a peculiar eye vision problem and you're not able to get your contacts or glasses to see straight, go see him and see if he can help you out. He doesn't charge extra for that, and a lot of other people do. So he's over at 2974 North Alma School Road, Suite Number 3 in Chandler. And it's a southwest corner of Alma School in Elliott and Chandler. And that's if you're in the area that I'm speaking from, which is the Phoenix area. Of course, if you can't see him because you live on the other side of the planet, which many of you do, find somebody like him. How do you find such people? Ask. Does he charge more? I've had trouble not getting my vision straight. Does this person or she or he charge more? And if they say no, you come in and we'll find a way to fit you somehow. And it doesn't matter how long it takes. We're not going to give up. Well, that's a good person to see. Go and try them. And then tell others about that person, because that's somebody that should be doing exactly what they are doing. You see? That's a good thing. So give him a call. I'll give you his phone number. I didn't do that. It's 480-899-0188, 480-899-0188, or www, you know, the old internet, theeyecenter.org, and check it out. All right, so back to our subject. Esoteric reality is a hidden reality. That's what the word esoteric means. And it is a reality that is more by far real or truthful or complete, whole, than the overall reality of illusion. Now, illusion sometimes has some small bits of reality in it, but it mostly is a composite of the desires and misperceptions of the human being while they're in worlds that are composed of such high density energies that all activities become a struggle. And struggling is not something that people really enjoy for the most part. And here's the bottom line about that. In order to reach a consistency in esoteric reality, you have to start enjoying the struggle. And here's how you can accomplish that. Enjoying the struggle is about being detached from the outcome. It's almost impossible to enjoy struggle, which is inherent in the lower mental, for sure the astral, and very, very sure the physical world, without detachment. Now, when you are attached to the outcome, the problem becomes that it's more important to achieve a certain result, good or bad or indifferent, than it is to help God and yourself to become more creative and more loving, more spiritual. You want to detach by realizing that the spiritual outcome of developing more spiritual parts of all life around you, including your own, is what you ultimately aim to do. And regardless of the other outcomes that may or may not achieve that, and even with that one inclusively so, regardless of any of the outcomes, by seeking to be more creative and more wisely giving, whether you achieve it or not, you grow closer to God. And God experiences you as a soul, and you experience yourself in that way. And therefore, you can sense God as it uses you as a window. Now, here's the interesting part about this. If you listen carefully to what I said, you then can say, well, wait a second. You're saying that even if your goal is to become spiritual, you have to detach from that. Yeah, you have to detach even from the goal of being more spiritual, which can lead to spiritual ambition, a very negative thing, because in itself there's a paradox. The paradox is that you would like to become more spiritual, but that desire is still selfish because it's about you. Whereas if you seek that everyone else becomes as spiritual as possible, regardless of the outcome of yourself, that one you can buy. That one you can go for, and that's okay. So that kind of outcome is what you can strive for. But the outcome of you becoming more spiritual or anything has a negative sign to it. Right? And detachment from outcomes in general leads to the overall improvement in esoteric reality and the obliteration over time of illusion. So there's a biggie. That should be very helpful for some of the folks. All right. And then if we take this into what I talked about a few minutes ago, and we look at it from the standpoint, okay, well, let's say someone is then looking for a way to, we'll say, have a very meaningful existence and be closer to God and all the other things that we generally speak of as good things. And they say, use their senses to experience the physical world in ways in which they don't control anything, but they give up control, and in ways that they don't have power, and they don't have significant amounts of money, or any specific material object, whatever it might be, then the gains that they seek have to do with gains in creating a world around them for the sake of others that relieves those others of the same kinds of goals of materiality and feeling good in a emotional sense. Now, instead of feeling good, and a lot of people say, well, okay, what you're going to get rid of that sex stuff and everything else, what's going to be the difference then? Well, what you want to feel is pure love. Pure love is, in its universal sense, a connection to and through and with God, to all other things, everything else, to help it to do the same and to experience a true oneness with the Creator by co-creation. Oh. So there's where you get to what replaces it. So when we say about sex, well, you're really, as I explained, you're really exchanging the sexual energy so the other person can now experience what you're like and vice versa. Sex is the beginning of the true experience of oneness with at least one other person in this particular case. Beyond sex, there are many other ways to experience oneness with others that is of a greater kind. It isn't about the astral nature. It gets into the Buddhic nature. And it can include sexuality, by the way, but it also many times doesn't. And regardless, it's this ability to co-serve with others together. And so service, or spiritual service particularly, becomes the replacement for all of these petty and small desires that people have. That doesn't mean you don't have sexual feelings, by the way. The sexual feelings become incredibly more intense, but their intensity is about the feelings of the and through and about the other person, and that about yourself. So two people who have this kind of sexual reality, one person is experiencing the sexual intensity at a much higher level, but from the perspective of what the other person is feeling and vice versa, and they are actually giving energy in the way that the other person needs it, not the way they do. It's really kind of, and you can read about this in the textbook I wrote. It's a little complicated. I have pictures in there. Most people look at the pictures and their eyes glaze over because they can't figure out what I'm talking about. I don't know why they can't, because I thought I drew kind of cute little pictures, and somebody else redrew them so that you can actually see what the pictures are about. My drawings look like scribble. But the point is that this is the problem, that it's so foreign to most people. That's why they can't perceive it. Not because it's so hard to see it. Because the diagrams are actually fairly straightforward. But it's not... It's like people go, what? Huh? Wait a minute, I have these feeling it from the perspective of the other person, and also thinking their thoughts and feeling their physical feelings themselves. The whole thing sounds crazy to me. Yeah, well, it does if you're in the illusion. And that's just the sex part. It's way more than that, of course. I'm using that one because it's easy to bring examples in, or easier for most people to get the examples from that. But you can use it from any perspective. Power and control are really the bigger factors in most people's lives. Some of it enters into sexuality, but it's not. This power and control thing is a huge issue because of the personality things. It's got to control what's going on. Okay. And we call that personal interest. But it really isn't personal interest. It's almost personal compulsion. Because people that are personality-driven are compelled to live their life within the physical realms of materiality. And then when they go to the astral world, within the astral realms of feeling good in some way. Everything is about how they feel. Of course, you can live that way here, too, and people do, all the time. And it leads to all kinds of nightmares. Because the more someone lives in the physical world based on how they feel, the physical part of their life falls apart because they aren't paying virtually any attention to interactions on a physical level, even those that are selfish. And then it gets into some real serious problems. They can become drug addicts, sexual addicts. They become a kind of fuzzy, whimsical life in which they no longer seek anything that is physical, but they seek to just feel happy and go lucky. Well, you can say, well, what's wrong with that? I like being happy and go lucky. Yeah, except you don't get to create anything because the happy-go-lucky person can't even figure out what they're eating today because they don't have any go-lucky money in their pocket. And they have no other substantial issues that gives them some ability to create in the physical world. Many times they don't have a job either. And you might say, well, I thought that you work based upon your creative needs and goals. Sure, that's what I suggest. But you still want to be able to make some kind of, as they call it, living. Because if you don't, then you can only live in a world in which other people are supporting you. And that further diminishes your ability to be creative. See? All right, so, in God's perspective, the human being is unraveling the chaos of the physical world, and it's highly chaotic because it has the highest level of uncertainty in it. And you say, wait a second, the uncertainty principle is smaller here. Why is uncertainty greater? Well, uncertainty is greater here from the standpoint on the macro level that our thought can't have any effect or virtually no effect on energy. So basically, we feel as though the world is chaotic and we are the victims of matter itself. Whereas in the astral world, our thoughts have a much greater effect on energy, which means if they're spiritual thoughts that we choose to have, we get closer to God very rapidly in the astral world. Here it's a struggle. And while the uncertainty principle, or quantum, the quantum constant, grows, when the quantum constant grows, energy is much more easily controlled by thought, especially by spiritual thought. Spiritual thought is much more effective in controlling energy than non-spiritual thought is. And you end up with a world which is actually much easier to live in, and one in which the forces that are created so strongly in the physical world are greatly diminished. This makes life easier to live in a spiritual way, and most people do live a more spiritual life, relatively, than how they live while they're physically alive. Are you following that? Because it's kind of interesting. Now, again, this is based upon physics. There's a lot of metaphysics in it, too, but it's still based upon physics. And that's why we talk about all these different subjects together. Okay. So, how does this all relate to us becoming our souls while we're here, and God then has a window more closely associated with this chaotic part of the universe, which is much more so than any place else? And you could say, well, if I was God, I would want to look in the window here, because this window could be pretty devastating. Well, yeah, if you're a human being, that's certainly a true statement. But to God, the most interesting places are the places where it has the least amount of effect on anything, and where the greatest level of freedom actually exists. Freedom from God's own thought, spirit, and where spirit has to struggle the most to assert itself. And that's right here. And as strange as it sounds, literally here. Earth, one of the most difficult planets in the entire universe, horrible place, is the place where God gets the most amount of meaning. Potentially. Now, if we blow up the world next week, I don't know that I can make that statement to be true, but in the struggle that's going on here, this is a very, very meaningful place, because the freedom afforded us and the ability to really, and we are struggling to try to overcome the darkness here, because this is one of the most darkest, evil places in the universe. Not all planets are dark. As a matter of fact, most are pretty enlightened. So here, this is a real dark one, and so here we go. But remember, that's the place where God gets the meaning, more so. And so when we get closer to God here, it's a small event. Everybody says, well, what meaning can my life be to God? God is this huge being. Why does it even concern itself with me? Well, that could be true if you really are here as the, as a fully illusioned person, you would have very little effect on God. But if you're a devoted spiritual person with some level of spiritual discipline, and you're actually being creative, which is the biggest issue, and then being loving with that creation as well, big time, you have a closeness with God that many other people will not have. And you say, well, how come I don't know about that? You haven't done it yet. But I can say somewhat from my own experiences and from others that I've seen, this is a true statement. So the meaning of one's life, even in the greatest of struggles, if you're in the physical world, can be, and I know this is weird as just about anything I've said today, can be this greatest intimacy and closeness with our own Creator. If we function as our soul at least a significant part of the time while we're physically alive. And then, of course, while we're astrally, but not, it's not as important then. It won't make as great a difference. You won't get as close to God as if you do it here and now. And that's a fact. That's just the way it is. This is the hardest place. The hardest planet, or one of the hardest planets in the entire universe, in the hardest dimension, the physical, and one in which great failure is taking place, even as I speak. And so here is the place where we have chosen as a soul to be. Every human soul that is on Earth, everyone, is here by choice. And every soul that incarnate, chooses to incarnate by choice into the physical world. Here we are. This is important because if we become our soul here, we recognize it is our choice to be here. It is our choice to co-create with others to bring more enlightenment into the physical world and to become closer to our own creator. This is all the choice, which leads to this enhanced meaning in life. And the only way you know it's true is if you try it and do it, because then you will. And then you'll come back and you'll say, you know, you were right. You were right. Yeah. And for the people who don't do it, they'll probably go in the opposite direction. Say, well, that guy on the radio is crazier than anything. He can't be right. Of course, they're making that up because they haven't tested for themselves. All right, so this becomes another whole other discussion, maybe other shows. I've done some shows more about this issue now. We are here because this is the best place that we can grow the most to become like our soul. It's not the easiest place to live. It's not the place where we will be the most virtuous in terms of our own specific behavior. But it's the place where we can grow the most to become our soul, period. Isn't that fascinating? I mean, it seems like they're almost opposite. So why should it be true? But it is. And so when we leave here, and I've talked to so many people, they say, oh, I can't wait till I go to the astral world, because if you're right, or I believe you're right, either way, when I get there, it's going to be a lot easier. Life's going to be more, hey, everything's based upon what I want to create for myself, more so. Energy doesn't control everything. Better balance of spirit. More loving people. Life is longer and far less suffering. And it's just a better place to live. Except for one thing, you can't grow as much. You lose your physical senses. You lose them. You don't have a physical body. And there's nothing to sense in the astral world that's physical. So you don't need that physical senses if you couldn't keep them. Now, part of the physical senses raises its vibration because part of the astral senses, that's a whole different thing. But I'm talking about the real or the actual physical senses that you have by your physical life, they're gone. And from the perspective of a lot of people, it first seems like a relief, and boy, is this going to be a great life, and this must be heaven because I got everything I want. There's even social justice in the astral world if you go to certain parts of it. But it's not on the higher spiritual parts. It's in the lower realms. And so you see, you've got this setup that people say, well, why worry? Let's be happy. And when we get to the other side, everything we desire will be ours. Except a meaningful life in co-creation with your soul and God. You say, well, it's just one exception. What's one little exception? Yeah. It's the very reason we came here in the first place. It's the very reason we stay here each lifetime. It's not a little deal. All right, so I hope I've broken that bubble. And here we now find ourselves in this quagmire of gaining God's, we'll say, vision through our soul, so that God grows and we grow at the same time. What proportion, would you think, of growth does God enjoy in comparison to us? I mean, everybody would think, right, well, God's going to grow way more than we do, because after all, God is this big being, and of course, anything that incorporates within itself, it can immediately use for everything else and all connected. And so it seems like God gets the better part of that deal. Nope, doesn't work that way at all. God gains a perspective from all the souls, like here on Earth, at about the same amount of its percentage of growth of creation itself, of itself, as a single soul does in itself, and a single human soul does in itself. The proportions are almost identical. What? How could that be? How could, who came up with that? And why? All right, here I go. This is not so easy to understand, but it is the truth as far as I know it. Okay. The way the system is set up, the perspective of a single being, human being, and its soul, when it is being enlightened, in percentage to its total consciousness, is approximately the same as the growth of God is through all the beings that it perceives through in its co-creation with those beings in relationship to its total consciousness. We are truly a reflection of our Creator. Yeah. I know, it's a biggie, isn't it? We are really, really just like it in so many respects as a soul. Now, this is an illusion being who's selfishly doing its thing, but when we're functioning as a soul, and especially in the physical world, this is more true. Yes, it starts to get skewed differently if you go to the astral and then the mental world, more towards the opposite, more towards, well, there's a greater difference, and God grows more than the human being. But here we grow more, we grow the most here, which is a very close to the Creator. And there is a fundamental reason which has to do with the mathematical formula, which I'm not going to get into tonight. But in a physics sense, what's really going on here is the physical world where we are right now is like the even point of matching the existence of the human being to the God that created life and that now is a equal co-creator with that human being while they exist here. And it's why humans have such amazing levels of the potential to grow, especially while they're physically alive, in comparison to anything else and in comparison to God. Here's another weird thing to talk about. We talk many times about the next kingdom and beyond that, the kingdom of souls and the spiritual kingdom in general, which is beyond the kingdom of souls. And, you know, we call that the spiritual hierarchy. But when we talk about this, and on into the planetary kingdom and the solar kingdom, these are names of more advanced beings, right? But here's the fascinating part about this. The same thing I just spoke about, the relationship of a human being to God, making the two pretty close to being the same in terms of the experience of consciousness relative increases, also holds true in relationship to the higher kingdoms. The higher kingdoms do not grow as much as the human does in terms of the physical world. And that just makes sense because these beings actually existed consciousness in the Buddhic realm or the intuitional world. They dabble or come to these lower worlds to serve and teach, but in reality, their job here is long ago gone for most of them, and they're not going to grow in percentage to this, that humans can while we're physically alive. I know I'm selling this bill of goods. It's hard to buy that this is the best place and this is the best time to grow the most amount and be closest to God while you're physically alive. I've been saying it for a long time, but how many of you actually believed it was true? And then how many of you understood the nature of the truth, which is what I'm trying to get to in today's program? Yeah, so we can now see we are in the prime location. Now, most of you say, well, my life sucks, and you're telling me that evil's after you and you're fighting evil. Isn't that, tell me that's not a good thing. That's a terrible thing. No, we're all fighting evil, believe me. And some of the worst evil can be against you when you're doing spiritual work. But that's not the point. The point is, this is the place to be most creative because you have all of your senses, and you're dealing with the most difficult of forces and problems while you're here. And it's a place where your percentage of growth equals that of God in its percentage of growth and consciousness. You and your Creator can share an experience here that is closer to being together than when you're in the astral or lower mental worlds finishing out this life. That's why I encourage people to do the most here. Now, granted, we burn up these bodies so fast through illusion, we grow old very quickly and we can't survive much because the illusions destroy us. That's what I talked earlier in the show about the 147 years. How many of us are living that long? Well, to my knowledge, nobody right now in this world. But the point is, that's because the forces we induce upon ourselves due to our illusions destroy our senses and eventually the body itself. When the senses go, if one sense completely fails, the body seldom can survive. It's gone. Goodbye. We need each sense we have, believe me. We got to have them. You say, well, what if you lose your eyesight? That's not the sense I'm talking about. The eyesight is an organ of the sense. You can lose the organ and still have some nature of the sense. When you lose the sense completely, that's a whole other thing. Then you're in big trouble. All right, so you got this thing, and it's an issue of the best of times, the worst of times. I know, I'm not Dickens. But the point is that it truly is both. That the forces are huge. The suffering is huge. And life is short. But the opportunities equal all of that. And the nature of getting closer to God has the following ingredients, which is the big plus. You know, I keep mentioning meaning. What does that mean? Well, the meaning of life itself is the most important element of, we'll call it, satisfaction in existence. The meaning of life becomes greatest when it develops the most amount of our consciousness and creativity or spirit. And that happens here in the physical world if we are able to live as a soul here. So then this meaning, which is so vastly important, is what our first reward is. Now, it doesn't mean that we feel good all the time. And it doesn't mean that we have a sense of peace. I know so many people that pray for peace. They should pray for meaning. Because what meaning is it's the percentage that a person has become one with all and co-creative with one with all at some points. So that's what meaning is. It's this co-creation with oneness, or the two parts of God's mind, being applied to the third part, which is activity with others. And when you have that, life has a totally different picture. The struggles become opportunities. The failures become education and lessons. The sacrifices become new creations. And the overall process becomes bliss. What is bliss? It's the state of consistently having new and greater joys, but consistency. And what is joys? Joys are the ability to take all negative consequences and turn them into a positive for others. That's a joy. In some way. Not for yourself, others in some way. It's seeing that what you've done is now contributed to the benefits of others. That's joy. So this is these things that we're talking about now are the reasons we're getting the benefits. And this is what you get. A life with meaning and joy and bliss and oneness and creation and education. I mean, it just goes on and on. It's the amazing life. It's the life of the soul here. Souls do not have this life that I'm describing for you, where they exist in the higher mental world, or if they're liberated souls in the Buddha. Why don't they? Because they're not as close to the creator as we can become here in the physical world. They're missing what is called as the completed monadic experience, or the experience of the lower realms altogether. What about masters? Don't they get it? Because they can create a maya rupa and become a body here, and they can get the body of light. Don't they co-serve? And all this? Yes and no. Yes, to some extent. For the most part, they still get it through the soul windows of their students and those that are trying to become students. They also get it from those that they co-create with as other with other souls, which are usually group souls and other individual souls that are oftentimes both human and superhuman. It all comes together. But it still is not as great an experience as a human can have while physically alive. I know I'm selling that really hard, aren't I? Yeah. Now, what happens if things really go awry? Let's say things go really badly. They might. I mean, we're facing a bad time, potentially, right now. And what happens if things just go really bad here on Earth? Well, first of all, we always have the option to leave. I want you to know that. But only when we're in the soul, soul's consciousness. When we return in full consciousness to the soul level, which is in the higher mental world. And from the second subplane, the fourth subplane, the second subplane of the higher mental world. From that perspective, if we choose to, and we say, you know what? isn't for me anymore. I'm not doing too well with my incarnations. It isn't going the way I'd like. I think I'll try a different world. That's it. You have an option. Very, very, very few souls take that option. And the main reason they don't take that option is because they recognize that no matter where they went to, the opportunity for all the things that I just said you can get while you're physically alive here will be substantially less, not more. The only times that souls do leave is when they think they're only going to screw it up for all the other souls. They have been so unsuccessful in their incarnations and in working with the other souls that they don't want to hamper them any longer. And as an act of sacrifice, they choose to leave, usually because they can't even create a new incarnation. Their body, the body of that being, will fail at some level because their consciousness is just not high enough to produce the right results. Those souls we can lament for. They do not leave because they want to go. They leave because it's the best that they can do, the best thing they can do at that time. And they will strive to do the best. That's a human trait of nobility, but that's at no less than that what they do. And so they will leave if necessary for the benefit of other souls and the whole planet, therefore. We should not think disparagingly about souls who do leave, therefore, because they are making still a great sacrifice, assuming my model, as I presented it today, is correct, of course. All right, so when we examine the entire situation and we put it all together, we come out to one big answer for tonight's show. That if we want to exist as a soul in this realm, and we want to have the very most meaningful, joyful, blissful, creative, co-creative with God, part of God, life here or anywhere, we need to do that in a conscious state while we are physically alive. If we choose that route, it cannot go badly, no matter what we think of as the end result. Either should be or seem to be. That's the answer. That's a big answer for tonight's show. I hope the esoteric reality and God's window through us now makes some sense. This has been a kind of big picture show. And hopefully it has resolved some questions that people might have about the nature of God in us. And if it's done that, then I've done my job, haven't I? And we are out of time for right now. So until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.